today we put a very specific and very restricted agenda. It's not a public hearing or anything like that. We are only discussing today the amendment of the Department of we decided yesterday that the whole was supposed to finish this discussion on Friday, but we felt that this time finish it today. And after the formal proceeding, after the discussions that we will have, before you come to the formal proceeding of adopting the report, we'll have a break. And then we'll allow that break at least to interact with whoever has got an interest in it to explain where they stand on the issue. But we will not invite any presentation because that's not the meeting. It's only to receive the work from the authority. So with that, I will invite Dr. May.
Thank you, Chair. One of the members, the advocate, has started to do the presentation.
I'm sorry, I really don't intend to bore you, but of course the nature of this particular presentation is that we're dealing with words and amendments that were proposed by the Select Committee. What we've done is, on the slide, we've put in the details so that it's easy for you to see. I'll just talk to that rather than repeating what's on the slide. Of course, the department has considered all the amendments that were proposed at the Select Committee that came out of the provinces, and that's really what you're seeing here. One of the suggestions from the provinces was that the word, a lot of it is cosmetic. And you can look at the detail on the slide and then refer it back to the bold if you need to double check. There was a problem with the word planning and with the word zoning, and there was a feeling that it would be confused with zoning in a municipal sense, and they felt that it would be better to substitute it with the word planning. So you will find that there's this cosmetic change to change the word zoning to planning throughout the bill, and those are reflected in these amendments. The other cosmetic changes were errors that were fixed up, for example, within the incorrect alphabetical order. If you look in clause one, the environmental authorization was placed in the wrong order alphabetically, and that was amended. You will find that change captured, and of course there's a lot of extraction from the text and then insertions in other places, and this all of these descriptions and narrations describe that process, but it really needs to fix up the alphabetical order of the definition. The next amendment was proposed by the Select Committee that came from the provinces was an error that was picked up in clause 9. What clause 9 once says, and if you look at the blue text, it looks at the corrected version, and that is what you're looking at now. It says the minister acting with the concurrence of the Minister of Land Affairs. Previously, it included the Minister of Agriculture. Nobody could actually make any sense of why the Minister of Agriculture was added in that particular instance, because there was really no role to play for the Minister of Agriculture, and everybody agreed that it was just it was probably a mistake, and the provinces suggested it get taken out, and we didn't have a problem with that. The following amendment is not cosmetic, because it has a real impact, in that it takes away the discretion of May and makes it a must, in particular with regard to the imposition of a fee. There was a strong feeling from the provinces that the minister has to require public consultation process before he imposes a fee. It should not be a discretion, and that was then amended accordingly. The next amendment was clause 15, where it was again cosmetic. You'll just see the under the blue section in 15.1, it says no person, owner, or occupier of land, and then the section goes on. They didn't like owner and occupier. They wanted to put no person, so that the offense looked like it addressed everybody and not specifically only owner and occupier. So that was just another cosmetic change proposed. The change that you see to clause 26 really an error because it relates back to verse 23 of the book. In clause 23, the minister is given the power to declare special management areas. But when you come to clause 26, and there's the power to adjust or adjust the boundaries of special management areas, that power was erroneously given to the MEC, which is incongruent. So that was corrected so that MEC was replaced by Minister. It really is just an error that was picked up. We also had no problem with that. Now, when you come to the proposed amendments to clause 27, these are more substantive in nature, and I'll talk to them as briefly as I can. Clause 26, sure. If we can go back to, if you look at clause 23 of the book here, it talks to declaration of special management areas. And 21 says, the minister may, after consultation with the MEC, by notice in the Gazette, declare an area that is wholly or partially within the coastal zone to be a special management area, or withdraw or amend any declaration made in terms of paragraph 8. And the rest of the section goes on to describe the process you must follow when determining these special management areas. Now, when you come to clause 26, which is a clause that was actually amended, 26 talks to the adjustment of coastal boundaries. Now, remember, if the minister has declared a special management area in terms of 23, there is another process which allows for adjustment of those boundaries. Now, that was erroneously given to the MEC. If you look at 26.1c, a special management, the coastal boundaries of 26.1c, the coastal boundaries of, and C says, a special management area may be determined or adjusted by the minister in accordance with section 23 by notice in the Gazette. That previously said may be adjusted by the MEC. So we've made it minister. It doesn't make sense for the minister to determine something and then the MEC to adjust it. That's really what that is about. If we go to the next one, this one's going to require some form of concentration at the very least because it's not cosmetic. It's one of the more substantive amendments that came out of the Select Committee. There's a lot of confusion and lack of clarity around coastal public property and when land gets excluded from coastal public property and what happens with reclamation and so forth. One of the problems that was picked up during the course of deliberations was that in terms of the Seashore Act, there was a power, the minister had the power to approve reclamation of land. And that was erroneously left out of this act. So there was a gap in the bill that didn't give the minister the power to actually reclaim land. So you have two processes. You have a process where, for example, land can be excluded from coastal public property, and we've been through that at the initial stages when this happens and under what circumstances. And the portfolio committee, in fact, added in clause 27 a proviso that there are certain instances where such exclusion must obtain the ratification of parliament and so forth. When it went back to the select committee, one of the things that was picked up was there's actually no power for the minister to reclaim land. So this was added. Now, I want to go through these clauses and then I'll talk to them and address questions if necessary. If you look at the new 5 in the blue text, it says land excluded from coastal public property forms part of state-owned land. Now, there was no indication of what happens to coastal public property once it's excluded. So we had to address that question. And the most sensible thing, and that is actually just perpetuating what happened in terms of the Seashore Act, is it must become something and it becomes state-owned land. Then, if there is a reclamation application or somebody wants land reclaimed, any organ of state, for example, the minister must be able to do this. So sub 6 was added, where it indicates that the minister may, on application, approve the reclamation of land. Such reclaimed land shall, unless excluded from coastal public property in terms of subsection 5, form part of coastal public property. So in other words, you've got two processes. If land is reclaimed, it can be reclaimed for and still form part of the net over which coastal public property is cast, other words, it still gets the protection of social public property and then can be disposed of or utilized in terms of the objective of the bill. Or it may be for other purposes. It may be, for example, for port development. And if such land is reclaimed, then it would have to then be excluded from social public property and then follow the rigors of 27, which gives you the process for that. And then become state-owned land, and then can be disposed in terms of the State Land Disposal Act. So it was these gaps that we had to, the practical implications of these sections that were addressed in these amendments.
Sorry, Chair. What you're doing in normal language is that you can reclaim land. Let's say you want to dig a port or whatever, or extend a port. But even though you, and therefore you, the land, change what you were doing before, now becomes used for this new whatever purpose it is, it will still remain public land.
Yes. It's a bit more nuanced than that. What happens, let's take the process from start to end. A part of a port, for example, where there's water, if there's sea now and there's seabed, and you want, you need to expand that port, and you need to create not berthing space, so that would still be. But you need to create a building there, because it's going to be part of the port infrastructure, for example. But in order to do that, you're going to have to turn that sea into land. That is what reclamation is. Okay, so you're reclaiming that land. Now, in order to do that, what do you have to do? Because right now, it would be part of coastal public property. It obviously hasn't been excluded yet. So, you want to excluded from coastal public property, which means you're going to come then go to clause 27, and 27(2) says the minister may exclude any area of coastal public property for government purposes by proclamation. Now, if it falls within government purposes, then we're going to get to the government purposes clause after we deal with this. Then the minister may do this by a proclamation. However, if one looks at sub 4, which says the minister may exclude any area from coastal public property for any other purpose other than government purposes with the ratification of Parliament. This was the amendment that was introduced by the Portfolio Committee. In other words, if it does not fall within the definition of government purposes, Parliament's going to look at it and say, well, okay, what do you want to do with this? Why do you want it excluded? Is Parliament happy with the reasons and they've exercised their oversight role over the coastal public property net? They're going to say, fine, yes, you may, or no, you may not. Now, if Parliament ratifies and says it's fine, this may be excluded from coastal public property. The next process is we need to reclaim that. So in order to reclaim that, there's a whole lot of environmental things that happen there. One of those, in order to to reclaim that, you've got to take a whole lot of, you've got to dredge up sand from somewhere else and spill out, which means there's going to be environmental impact and all of this. So you've got to then apply for this reclamation to happen, and then it goes through the EIA process, which is dealt with in a separate process. Now, then when that land is reclaimed, if it's already been excluded, that's fine. Then it you can do with it. Then it becomes state-owned land. So in other words, ports, for example, now the way they've been doing it in the past is you've got land that's reclaimed and it needs to be registered and so forth, and then it will go to the registry office and it will be dealt with in terms of that legislation because now it's state-owned land. So it falls under auspices of public works, the way things normally work. It is part of coastal public property. Obviously, then it remains within the net of coastal public property, and all the restrictions that apply to coastal public property would apply to that land. That's what it means. Are we okay on that? Having spoken about the power of the minister to exclude via proclamation from coastal public property, by proclamation for government purposes, we need to determine what is government purposes. And one of the things that was probably in the committee was when can a minister do this and when not? And if one looks at 7, sub 7 in the blueprint, this is the proposal for the purposes of this section. Government purposes means the exercise of functions by an organ of state that are in the national interest or in the interest of national security, but does not include donation, leases of more than 20 years, or alienation by that organ of state. So it is for any, if it's for reasons other than what is contained in here, and these were clauses that were taken from, borrowed from other pieces of legislation and so forth, the minister may do it. If not, it must come to Parliament. So if it's for purposes of donating this land, if it's for purposes of selling this land, if it's for purposes of long-term leases, Parliament has an oversight role to play. That was the effect of this. If I could just have a minute, there's something that my colleague has picked up. The next amendment was to clause 32. There were certain technical concerns that were raised by the provinces with regards to the Land Survey Act, and they wanted that tidied up. So it's really on. It says when he talks about the diagram in terms of the Land Survey Act, they wanted it more fully explained. So they preferred the section to read. If I can just go to clause 32 so that it makes sense to say a diagram as defined in terms of the Land Survey Act.
Anything, any rectification happening before this amendment, as they can maybe afterwards be cut?
The legislation can only apply after it's passed. There's no provision that says this applies retrospectively. So it's on the date that the act commences is the day that the law comes into force. If I may continue if one looks at clause 32. I just need to find out the NEC has been. The minister at NEC may, as may be appropriate, must notify the relevant register of deeds. I'm just looking to see. Must be accompanied. If you look at 2B, what has been added, it was previously, it said on page 22, after a diagram of the land which is signed by a land surveyor, they insisted on the insertion of the word as defined in section 1 of the Land Survey Act to make it more specific. And then added the act into that is clarity purpose really. Clause 34, also a cosmetic change, but not really cosmetic, because it would have an impact. They wanted person to be substituted with the word body, because you really are dealing with bodies rather than persons in this instance, so it made more sense to do that. Clause 35, it was again making provincy for the minister to establish a national cultural committee. The provinces insisted that it should not be a discretion, but it should be an obligation, and therefore the change was made to must. Clause 40. There was a concern. They wanted to broaden some of the powers here, and one of when they talked to the provincial coastal committee, they wanted to add in, make it as representative as possible. And one of the suggestions was added in the blue, which says the provincial coastal committee and it talks to the representation, must include representatives of government who play a significant role in the undertaking of regulating activities that may have an adverse impact on the coastal environment. And we know there's many departments that are engaged in activities that impact on the environment, and just to make sure that that's covered at provincial level, this amendment was proposed. Also on the appointment, the provinces felt strongly about including members from municipalities in the coastal zone, as well as members representing community-based and NGOs. And these were strong recommendations coming from the provinces, which we didn't have a problem with. In clause 49, there were certain technical issues that were proposed with regard to municipal coastal management programs, and this was as a result of the province's consultation with municipalities, where they felt that the municipal programs must include priorities and strategies to address coastal erosion and accretion and to deal with coastal access issues, which wasn't clearly spelled out, also an improvement in our view. Clause 56 was again the zoning and planning substitution of the words. So I'm not going to speak to that anymore. Those were as a result of comments that came through in the provincial hearing, where they felt that in order to get a more comprehensive and integrated approach to it, when decision-making was taking place at provincial coastal committees and interfering into national committees, the more representative it is of NGO representation as well as community-based organizations, the less resistance there would be to implementing these plans later on. So to get... that was what I understood it to be.
I don't know. I'm just asking about I'm worried about it. Isn't public participation enough? What?
Chair, we didn't think that it was essential, but the provinces were mooting for this very strongly. They were...
Well, I'm not sure. I wouldn't want to develop them or whatever to be held down by interest. Some of these NGOs appear to be self-interest, but you never know who supports actually. They're red. You never know who supports. So for me, if the people are involved, that should be enough. They can come as part of the people. But whether you want to insist on non-communal localization, I'm not so sure. And that complicates the time boundedness of this because I don't know. I'm very deep.
I'm just trying to think, you know, as you're asking those questions, to what extent would our material alteration require that this bill must go back to the MCOP? Or can just agree just to edit it in our final version? We can do this in the assembly, and that's the end of the story, and this is the president. So that's why I was contemplating on. In terms of process, if we can be guided, if we find difficulty in the SOP, you know, recommendation, that's what we're saying. Must we still send the bill back to them, or are we the final editor, so to speak, so our version holds true? So I was in a contemplative mood. Compared the process, you must have misjudged me. And from this remark here, you can see the depth of my sagacity.
Thank you. Thanks, Chair, and my apologies for joining a bit late. I'm not going to deal with the parliamentary procedures. I don't think I'm competent enough to talk to that. But in respect to what is in research, in respect of the role of the coastal committee, they deal with the broad planning, and they don't necessarily make decisions on individual development. You would undergo a normal public participation depending on the nature of the development. So we were not quite, concerned about the recommendation by the NCOP to include members of the NGO sector or community-based organization. It's an ongoing consultative structure based on broad planning and just general management of the issues along the coastline, which is something that I think that if it can be achieved, I think it would be a good model for a long-term resilience of the management of the system.
I'm not sure. Because for me, I think this is a material thing. Because my worry about this, you see, you might have a situation, we've had situations where legislation has been thrown out by the Constitutional Court, and I don't want to be embarrassed by that. Because there was not a proper public participation process. Now, here you can even differ and mention NGOs. Now, some NGOs may feel that it's not been consulted, it has an interest in that area, and therefore hold the whole thing and have its case standing up at a very important legislative judicial level. That's my worry about this. I don't think this is a. Do we have no lawyer from Parliament yet?
Chair, I don't know. I don't agree with you, Kirsty. There's no. What's the difference then between this and the previous formulation of the National Environmental Advisory Forum, where in the previous formulation, NEMA, the minister, was obliged to take an individual which he appointed or she appointed from a certain sector? That wasn't unconstitutional. Because this body, quite frankly, it's a nice body, but it's got no power, this body, actually. It does. For all intents and purposes, this body does very little and is probably, to be completely cynical, never going to work effectively. There is nothing wrong with including small consultation and interest in it, and it's been done previously under the National Environmental Advisory Board.
I asked them a process point inspired by your objection, which is that I support. Because I was going to say, let me just look two fronts intervention. Is the president in a legislation where an inclusion of an NGO was defended there instead of, as opposed to just open public participation, because NGOs are part of the public. Because if you say NGO, what stops it from saying union, what stops it from saying churches, mosques, temples, etc. Let's see. I think the chairperson is right. It shouldn't be still say NGO. But NGO are a sector. What about the churches? What about the soccer world, sporting world, etc. Then you see, we make a different institutional approach. I think we should do NGO. But my point is this. Let's say we agree to scrap NGO now. In terms of process, as a political committee and other, must this thing go back to the NCOP process? Or can you go from here and parachute straight into the National Assembly?
No, I think
what's the process?
In terms of the process, if we've got reservations about this thing, it should have to go back to the NCOP.
In terms of what
mediation.
Yeah, exactly. I'll have a chat to you still on that part. Because it does appear a matter of the goal, that goes.
Manganga?
Chair, thank you. Chair, I would like to support what Aubrey has just said. According to an input by a certain Vuyo, I couldn't get that the paper now. Vuyo said in his input that that portion was now sold to the pension fund. And in terms of, when we speak about the pension fund, Chairperson, we are speaking about people. And which means we are going to have endless problems with that piece of land. Mm. That, what is this? What net? That poor net, what is it?
Transnet
sold it to the pension fund. And when we speak about the pension fund, we are talking about the lives of people. Children, grandchildren, and it seems to me we are going to have endless problems as far as this portion is concerned. And I just wanted to support what Aubrey said that about Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
One of the reasons. Thank you, Chair. Getting rid of the National Advisory Forum was because it was stated that there would be small committees such as the Provincial Coastal Committee that would probably be more appropriate and more manageable than the National Advisory Forum, which didn't seem to be functioning properly. Now, I just wonder, in terms of the, when it says the MEC must appoint persons to the Provincial Coastal Committee, will there be regulations that will govern how that will happen and when it is thought to be appropriate? And who would approach the MEC saying, look, there is a problem, now we need to appoint the provincial? Who takes the decision to appoint a Provincial Coastal Committee? And I must say, in support of Maranzanga, as far as Section 27 is concerned, I'd like to know how this does affect the arrangement as far as the Transnet sale is concerned. With, wait a bit, let me go back to it. Because the question was asked, was it retrospective, and it's not. So what? Where are we left in terms of that particular problem that we have discussed and encountered earlier? Thank you, Chair.
I wanted to find out from the Republic. I know how they work.
I was asked about the process point. Now, the other point is there any parallel in legislation where you juxtapose public participation with NGOs. In other words, you say, let there be public participation, but that public participation must also include NGOs.
No, I actually misunderstood this because in terms of the version here, it appears to be equating the NGOs to public participation. It's not like that. The issue here, what they are saying is that when constituting this provincial coastal committee, that also brings it from the NGOs. It's not like saying that it has nothing to do with public participation. It's about the provincial committee. I don't know. You can't just set up a little thing there and say Stockton is an NGO. It's not an NGO. Because it must be registered. There are lawmakers here. So let us not create something that we will not be able to uncreate. An NGO must have, must be registered with these people as an NGO. You can't just have an NGO, everything is an NGO, a church is an NGO. Of course, there is church, so nothing is with the government. But that does not make it qualify as an NGO. But here, we're talking law here. We want to avoid a situation where you have public participation, but then you have and the NGO is coming up and saying, look, you didn't consult me. And then they say to the consular council, of course, you didn't consult the person there. In terms of law, so and so, you should have consulted NGOs. I do not tackle the case. Remember, it's my own motivation. But you say, I do not want this decision to not hold up. When people are feeling or whatever. However, I thought that I was reading from the text here, not in the context of the actual text of the legislation. When I looked at both of them, what's the range there? So that is to do with public participation. I thought in the context of public participation that it would be a misnomer, would have gone ahead. But it's about constituting committees. I said that even the committee on the provincial social management committee, please ensure that all of the scientific people,
from the NGOs, etc. It's fine. It's not a political thing. I thought it was about public participation, not about public participation. I don't know. I want to talk about it. But what about the fact that if you don't actually have those NGOs, that will render this thing legitimate?
Why should it be a problem to have an NGO set up from NGO?
No, no, why shouldn't there be a problem not to mention NGO specifically?
No, but it mentions all sorts of other people from there, scientific people, NGOs. NGOs are a vested, have a vested interest in the issue. What I, for me, I thought this was had to do with public participation. And there I would want public participation to also add NGOs. That I didn't want to happen. But if it's about contributing a vested interest of experts, NGO brings a form of alternative knowledge, which is important in decision making. But let's just look at the sociology of knowledge formation. They bring another important dimension.
Yeah, I'll yield to a person except that the question of local standards. Because if anybody is going to bring a case of challenges, they must act on the basis of the right to bring this to court. And they will read a particular clause, the clause and so says, you shall have this, and it's in your or in terms of law, so and so, I qualify. And I was in the constitution of this, I'm just thinking ahead. I wouldn't like to judge it too much, but I think we must also be very careful not to take those platforms that will render this bill vulnerable.
Another file of
the honorable member,
and take comfort in that this is not mandatory that you have NGOs. It talks about including NGOs and other stakeholders like also CBOs, community-based organizations. So it is not mandatory that you have the NGOs.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. If you look at the next one, there were inputs that the municipal cultural management program had to address priorities and strategies around addressing cultural erosion and accretion, as well as dealing with cultural access issues. And we thought that was an improvement because it will need help for watching this to prioritize. I'll leave that to Dr. Malani. He's very good at describing these scientific processes, the opposite of erosion. Erosion where something gets taken away, accretion is where you adding things.
Yeah, it's very important.
Can I please hand over to the expert in his oceanography?
Thank you, Chair. We've seen a lot of erosion along the coast, and we believe it's good to have them included in their coastal management program. Where it's not eroding, and there are very few cases like that, the coast will be growing forward. In other words, the coast will be getting bigger, and that is what's called accretion. For example, if you get a lot of sediment coming out with a river, the coast can grow. It will get bigger and the sea will get smaller. Yes, but there are very few cases along that.
Thanks, Chair. Again, substituting planning for zoning is dealt with in these, so you'll see after all this happens. The next one was with regard to dumping.
Sorry, I don't think we can gloss over that. Zoning and planning. Zoning to me appears to be very more decisive. Like, in terms of town planning, we apply for zoning for business to zone for this or that, etc. Now, planning would be something more general, not so specific. Now, why forgo what is more specific? And go for the general, which can open a loophole.
It's really not going to open a loophole. What it's going to do is it's going to align it with the municipal legislation. It was a terminology thing that we didn't want to cause confusion. That is why they brought it up. It's actually a valid concern. It's not going to change the content. If you call it a plan as opposed to a zone, it's not going to change the content because the content is prescribed. But it will clear up any misunderstanding so that it's not confused with zoning in terms of the municipal law.
So, what is the context of the zoning?
I'll
tell you why I'm asking this question here. Because there's a lot of hype about the fact that whether Robben Island is part of the zone, et cetera, the sea is part of the zone. So, that is the actual context. I wouldn't like us to come up with some Sunday school, you know, harmless looking thing, when in fact it will be used to say, aha, it's planning and not zoning. And then we've left a window there. But there's a context to this whole thing.
I think that it relates to alignment with other legislation, and in particular with the Land Use Management Act and with provincial planning legislation, as well as with the municipal system legislation, where because the way that things happen in municipalities are done differently, in all of that legislation has been agreed that you talk about planning in general, and then the specific means of planning that is applicable either in that province or in that municipality then comes into effect, because not all of them do zoning, they do other things. So that's the reason. It's quite technical in order to have a formulation that links to other pieces of legislation.
Point taken.
Okay. The next amendment that was proposed was regarding dumping permits. It was felt that the transboundary impacts and international obligations and standards
need to be specifically mentioned, which we thought was an improvement. It really says when deciding an application for a dumping permit, the minister must have regard to transboundary impacts and international obligations. I don't think that there's any principal problem with that. Clause 83, there was 83.1, the minister may make regulations relating to, and there's a whole list of things that he may make regulations on, and one of the things that was thought to be a priority emanating from the provinces, any activity which has an adverse effect on the coastal environment, which is quite wide, but it then strengthens his power to regulate in detail on coastal conservation. The clause, the proposed amendment, the amendment in clause 89 from the NCLP was also just a cosmetic one because they felt that the section, it's really just an amendment to the heading of the section. They felt that the section dealt with delegations and enforcement, and that's really the change that was effected there. Clause 95. There were additional words here that were very clumsy. If you look at clause 95, which is subject to subsection C, this act does not affect the continuation of a lawful lease on, and it had the words land or premises that forms part of coastal public property. And we were trying to determine now what does that mean? What is land or premises that forms part of? And in order to avoid interpretational problems later on, it was thought best to omit the words land or premises and just say a lawful lease on coastal public property, which would then just generally cover anything to do with coastal public property. Chair, that was the extent of the amendments that came from the committee. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks for those amendments. I respect the Chair's decision that this is a public hearing, but I think we should ask the department and the officials here how the amendments that exist now before us correspond to what Transnet have been asking for and in meetings with you asking for. So, from a departmental point of view, where do we stand on this matter at the moment?
Stand in the line of duty.
Not a fire.
Very strict. Chair, the issue of the sale is really not the issue. The issue is with regard to the bill, whether and we've been engaging with the Department of Public Enterprises as well as Transnet at various stages of the parliamentary process, as everyone is aware, with regard to the impact on ports and so forth. And there was a whole lot of debate on whether there should be an exclusion, and if so, what the nature of that exclusion should be. And that has really been the bun fight. But I think there's a common understanding that the idea behind the bill is not to impact on legitimate port operations. And we have, in subsequent discussions with the Department of Public Enterprises, been led to understand that there may be some practical implications with regard to the bill on the court. But we're saying that, and this has always been the case, that there are mechanisms in terms of which we can deal with this, and that's why Section 27 was put in place. So in order for us to address those kind of port operation issues, we're engaging in cooperative governance and government with the other departments on trying to find a solution in terms of the existing clauses in the bill to deal with their problems so that the bill doesn't unduly impact on the operations. And if need be, these will be channeled through Parliament for ratification in the normal course as prescribed in terms of the bill. And I think that that would be the best way forward, because all the parties then would come to some kind of agreement, and then we would deal with the issue of which areas exactly are affected, how they are affected, and which is the best way to deal with them. So I think that that matter is pretty much in hand at the moment, as far as the department is concerned.
Okay.
To come through, Honorable Maluna, we welcome you.
The law advisory had to go discipline to me 27, 6 and 10.
For the purposes of the section, okay. There are two ways the seat is regarded as coastal public property. We're starting there. Because coastal public property belongs to everybody. And it's for the protection and conservation of everybody. Now, it has special status and it must be taken care of in a special way. So, if you want to take land and exclude it from coastal public property, there must be processes in place that that are solid, that are that have checks and balances in place. So, what 27 does, if you look at 4.7, if you look at 3 and 4, it says that we're not saying that this is an immutable principle. We're not saying that coastal public property can only remain that and it can never be anything else, because that would be impractical. There are obviously needs that are that need to be in the settlement operations that you need to consider. And there may be instances where this is necessary. But in order to do it properly, the minister has a certain discretion to exclude it by proclamation. And if he does that, he's got to follow a public participation process, which is very rigorous, which means that everybody has input. You publish it for comment, everybody's going to say, we object, or we're okay with it, or we think this needs to be taken into account. And then only the minister can proclaim or de-proclaim those specific areas. But the instances in which the minister can do this is if it's for government purposes. Now, in other words, if an organ of state has a legitimate mandate that they have to fulfill, and they need to be able to do certain things, like birth vessels, and you can't unduly restrict them in their operation of a port because you've got the social public property thing hanging over there. So if you want that excluded, and it's within the definition of government purposes, then the minister can do it. Now, 27.7 tells you what government purposes are. So in other words, it creates the rules for when the minister can do this exclusion. That's what it's saying. So it's saying if there's an organ of state, and we look at all the organ of state that we find in the constitution, needs to do something that's in the national interest. Now, these are phrases that have been tested in the court. Okay, we use it, national interest, interest of national security, very important things that government has to do in day-to-day operations that's going to impact on the public as a whole and the citizens as a whole. This is what it is. If it's for national interest, in other words, the government departments should have work to do. But it does not include, even if that is part of their work, the organ of state part of the work, it does not include if you're going to sell that land. It does not include if you're going to donate that land or that coastal public property. And it does not include if you're going to enter into leases for more than 20 years. So in other words, then you can say, well, it's a 20-year lease renewable for forever. And then it's just the same as alienating it. So we're saying when the minister's power is exercised, it can only be if it's for any purposes that does not include that. The minute you want to sell, the minute you want to donate, the minute you want to enter into long-term leases, Parliament must say okay.
So in other words, what you're telling me today is, with that transit deal, the minister was consulted, Parliament was involved. That's what you're telling me. That's what I asked the question the first time. But I want to know, if you can take property like that, which belongs to this country, to the people of this country, and you can sell it to a private company. What say that the people have in that matter? Well, nobody has a say in that matter there. Now listen to what my comrade is saying opposite that side. You must look careful to this business here, Chair. I'm very worried.
Chief, as far as the sale was concerned, I think the portfolio committee was addressed quite fully on that issue by Maria Ramos.
After the sale.
Yes, after the sale. And that really is not, this bill isn't going to do anything with that sale.
Okay.
And all the processes that were followed in the sale was explained to the committee by Transnet. But the bill can't regulate the sale. It's not intended to regulate the sale of land. This provision on sale is talking about if you want to exclude from coastal public property. Selling is an issue that's governed by other legislation. But what you're going to do with that, with the area of coast and sea that's within the jurisdiction of the bill, that's what this bill regulates. So the decision to sell this bill does not regulate.
I think, Chair, the presenter has actually clarified that the issue of say is not something that we're dealing with in terms of this deal. What, in terms of the presentation that was made by Transnet, which we thought is putting them in a bit of a difficulty, was a possible vacuum wherein their port areas are not yet excluded or exempted, and how do we then deal with that? And we were trying to do something about that because we thought they don't necessarily want to take our word for it, that it would be done concurrently with the Act coming into law. So we have gone further in our interactions with Transnet and DTE in processing that exemption. They have already given us the coordinates of the various port areas, which we are in agreement with, or the team indicated that they've looked at them and they are in agreement, and we will then basically then follow through the process wherein the minister can make a decision to therefore exclude or exempt those areas, confined port areas, in terms of Section 27 of this year.
Just on clarity, Transnet owns huge portions of land on either side. For instance, in Port Elizabeth, it owns land from Cape to Cape right up to the Swartkops River. In the future, if it wants to, in future, this bill will kick in. Okay? If it wants to sell off or whatever happens in the future, yeah.
See, there's two separate things. There's the land, which in terms of which there's ownership, and the land and buildings and infrastructure is owned by the National Ports Authority, by Transnet, ostensibly by Transnet.
There are no buildings.
When you're talking about the land side of issues, this bill is not intended to even deal with that. This bill is talking about the coast. So we're talking
about
the other extent is we're talking about the extended areas of sea over which they have jurisdiction. There are overlapping mandates between them and us on those areas. But those areas form part of coastal public property.
Yeah.
And I think that that's commonly understood, that it still stands as coastal public property. If there are any exclusions, and those exclusions happen within the footprint of the port areas, which are your legitimate port areas or your bona fide port areas, whichever you want to call them, which are the areas excluding the extended reserve areas, like the going up to Robben Island, etc. They would still have jurisdiction over there in terms of certain things in their act. But we also have jurisdiction, the deep jurisdiction over that sea area also prevails. And that's where... if there's any exclusion to happen, and what the DG was referring to was a discussion around not impacting on the ports, which is your physical force, because there was once we have the coordinates, which is the restrictive coordinates, then we can talk about the exclusions in terms of, and which we do have. We've agreed with both parties have agreed on the extent of those coordinates. They don't interfere with those large expanses at all. They really often have four areas, and that in any sense will still come back to the portfolio committee. It will come back to Parliament for portfolio committee. If I'm hearing the concern correctly, I think there is, though, in relation to, I mean, the fact is that the state is a large landowner in South Africa, and organs of state are large landowners, and municipalities and provinces and everybody else, and they do dispose of land, but there is a separate regulatory framework that then comes into place in relation to what can or can't be done with that land as well. So in addition to this, you've got everything else that does apply.
My concern is that I think it almost needs a few test cases to see what would happen if, for instance, in Port Elizabeth, part of the Transnet land. They wanted to, and it's public. It's owned, as far as I'm concerned. I would ask Dr. Malone to for a little more clarity on this. But as far as I know, it's not attached to the port. It's an extended area that runs along the coast towards East London. But it is owned, in fact, by Transnet. And my concern would just be if they wanted to develop that, how much public interest would be taken into account as far as management of that land is concerned. It's on the coast, yeah. You can walk along the beach the whole way. Yeah.
Some that will appear, but just before that, right?
Yeah, the lawyer, the highly qualified lawyer, I forget his name, who representing Transnet or Excel, lecture to me.
Jamie
Horton. So, yeah, he said the process has already been started of unlimiting every portion of the coast. All what we must do is to complete it in respect of the environmental aspect. Now my question is, what is it, and I'm thinking from a devil's advocate point of view, what is it that we as a portfolio committee are embellishing or completing which other people left halfway? And which we could be accused of having completed. That everything is now nice and sealed now. Because of what we are doing now. Apart from this, for the thing of coordinates, you as functionaries, look at the coordinates, we don't know what those coordinates look like. Because I understand that why Transnet came up with that cabinet, or because they thought they had it all right, but if you come up with this integrated court remembrance, we are now bedeviling the process. What is it that we are bedeviling here with this law, which we are now happy with that we're not bedeviling? That's the crux of the
matter.
That's the crux of it. What is it that we are doing so nicely now, which now pleases now? I know this is about the sale of the land, but that sale of the land had a kind of a whip. Now, we came up with it. In other words, if we didn't come up with this integration of the Act, everything was quite a kind of legislative of life. Once we come up with this bulldog legislation from the EIA point of view, we are then hindering that thing. What is it that we are now making easier with this law, which would not have been easy if this law had not passed? I'm not going to pass.
Yeah, I'm not certain that what I wanted to say is going to help or hinder at this point. The reality is that Transnet is an organ of state, it owns land. If Transnet decides it no longer needs a piece of land and it wants to sell it for whatever reason, whatever land it is, Transnet, that sale and the development that follows the sale is subject to the existing regulatory framework. So Transnet would then have to do an EIA in relation to the development. In that EIA, they would have to do the public participation that is necessary. If there was then a requirement for the rezoning of that land, then they would have to go through whatever the rezoning process is in that local municipality with all of the requirements, in the same way as any other landowner or person wanting to do a development has to. So I think that what we need to look at it is that there is a legislative framework around land use management, land use planning, land development in the country that applies. This legislation looks at taking special measures in relation to protection of the coastline, but it does not replace or substitute for any of the other legislation that in the normal course of events kicks in relation to this kind of development.
That's okay. Just 1 minute. I really need to understand this.
If you talk about land, it's something different. If you talk about coastal land, that's what worries me. If any organizations that have the rights of property, coastal property, what I want to know, this legislation, in the future, in transit, for instance, if transit goes around the Milton area now in Cape Town, on the coastal land, and they see themselves fit to develop the land, and afterwards they're going to sell it then to a private owner. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I want to try to figure out. Can they do it without government interference? That's what I want to know. That is what I want to know. If you say to me, no, this will cover this, then I'm satisfied.
Because I don't understand this. Land is sold. Whenever land is sold to people, we have to get title deed to show that that land belongs to us. Now, here, we are talking about something else. Something that is belongs to Transnet, then given to the pension fund, then I don't know whether it's back to the Transnet again. Where's the title of that piece of land to show that the land really belongs to Transnet, except what those gentlemen told us, because a gentleman from Transnet came here and told us about this, the sale of land that part belongs to, that part belongs to them. Mm-hmm. And we were worried that next time they'll tell us Parliament belongs to them. So, where's the title?
No, the crux of the matter is this, my understanding, and say if I'm wrong, it's about EIA. That's what it's all about. That red cell has purchased a certain portion of the coast of that consortium. And if we then come up with this type of a law that wants to regulate, that wants to integrate all kinds of, we're entitled to say there must be an EIA exercise. And that's where Transnet, no. NIMBY syndrome, not in my backyard. This one, we must never talk to us about EIA because it belongs to us. I'm trying also to indirectly to Mr. Manzan. So in other words, it's now private. You guys can do EIA all over the country, not here. NIMBY syndrome, not in my backyard. So that's the crux of it, about the EIA impact. That's what it's all about. Now, I want to find out, and they're not coming forward to say, through passing this legislation, are we saying, EIA will not apply now because this has been what's called that, or what. That's actually what is actually the crux of this matter. Because if there wasn't that financial transaction, that pay transaction, historically, about this petition of some portion, certain parts of
I think,
then this argument would not be arising. Because it will be neutral and calm. But now, we are coming up with this law to try and integrate it, come up with an integrated post amendment. And we are now treading on the toes of this deal, which is supposed to include ownership or purchasing of certain portions of the coast. If there wasn't that deal, then we wouldn't be sitting here with the first part. This I would never have this extensive, you know, provincial consultation that would promise nothing. Because there wouldn't have been any emotions around. The emotions around this are because a process has been started to try and purchase certain portions of the coast, prime land, etc. Now, we are coming up with a law to integrate the coast. And part of that integration is that our mandate to conduct EIA, that certain things development will not take place without a cyber EIA exercise. And that is why other guys are jumping. No, please. Don't even turn our toes now because we are going to inhibit the EIA, the result of the EIA. They actually say this and this shall not happen. And that will now conflict with our business plans to develop those portions. So that, I think, is the crux of the matter.
Honourable members, can I just further try and clarify this? I mean, the Honourable Member Mukwena earlier on was asking what is it that we are legitimizing or not legitimizing. Any deals that Transnet was involved in, whether you say they had to follow particular legislation, this deal does not deal with those. And when we talk about a proclamation that would exclude certain areas, even currently the maps that I have here for Cape Town, it does not go up to, the coordinates do not go up to Robben Island, nor include the parts of the waterfront area where there is development. So this is purely in relation to what we are responsible for in terms of coastal integrated coastal management. All the other legislation still applies. Transnet has always been expected to undergo processes of EIA, and they are still expected to do that. That is not going to be then duplicated in this legislation, and therefore that's not included in this legislation. And all the other laws that, whether it's in terms of the Department of Transport and so on, they still have to adhere to all of those other pieces of legislation. All we are now talking about is what we have a domain of responsibility for as the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism, which is what we then say we have all the safeguards that you require in terms of Clause 27 and the various subsections in respect of how you do the exclusion or how you do a reclamation. And those are the things that we're saying we have taken from the old legislation. They still had to conform to the Seashore Act in terms of the old act, which is what we would repeal by this legislation. And the question, if you have a question on whether they've complied with all of those other pieces of legislation, then it's something else that can be dealt with outside of this bill that you have to vote on, honourable members. So I think the key thing is that currently we clarifying the issues that were brought in by Transnet, and we had agreed, I thought, in the previous meeting that the key aspects of what we want to manage and control for the future sustainability of managing the coast are well catered for in terms of Clause 27. And I don't think the other discussions that we are entertaining are going to be able to then undo that decision that you took when we then referred the bill to the select committee.
No. Chairperson, I'm so disturbed of chair.
when Transnet came here 2 months ago, and I said, what are they doing here? Because the bill is before the SOP. We must first get the response from the SOP. Why did Transnet come jumping here? What was worrying?
Okay,
so you can work from Yeah, but I want to find out. But that is not what it is directed. That was recommended this company. But the process is started now. You guys must not halt it or be devilish. What is it now that we are not halting? What is it that we are smoothing now?
Okay, let me say this, Kongo. I think France is still here. They wanted to address us. Because they still feel that was decamping them. So it's not as though they are here smiling. They are here. Someone from the Minister of Office, from the DPE, from Transnet. They're all here. So maybe they may. But that's for, I don't know, academic purposes. Because as we are, the project of this is now cannot be addressed. Because if we do that, then the matter will have. We'll delay this thing, so it will be dealt with by the next parliament.
Yeah.
Otherwise, if we don't address it now, it's.
That's for our own protection, Chester, I hear very well. When you started, you said we shall not come again. Now, you should not then open the window for Transnet to come, because then what happens now, we are now opening up the window, then that engine is going to jump up and so on. So, we must very, very careful.
Yes.
We must very, very careful not to open the sluice.
Yes.
Because it might be the same end. Okay. No. I'm asking the department ourselves, not the Transnet response here, because I mean, this could be a subject of litigation, etc. We would like to compromise that on this day we actually asked them, and they warned us, they told us once and for five. So we want as parliament to actually say, are we doing the proper thing? If we are doing that from the fund, and that we mustn't leave any donor, because we're not trying to obstruct anything. At the same time, we do not want to give leeway for other unintended consequences.
Could you
open the
door?
Okay,
I'm going to try to address Honorable Mokwena's concerns, and it seems to me to be around the sale, because that's where this started. And I think perhaps that's what's still remaining unsettled in lots of people's minds.
Mm.
What started this was when Lex Shell came to the portfolio committee, and it was not Transnet. It was Lex Shell who came there and said, we have a deal with Transnet. What is your bill going to do to this deal? And that's what got set the cat amongst the pigeons. And I think that everybody then concentrated on the sale, when in fact, perhaps that is the red herring in this. The sale may have brought out a whole lot of other issues and made us look at the bill more closely and look at these issues more closely. But one must remember that from that time that Advocate Gauntlet came to address the committee, many, many things have happened, and we've managed to try and get different and clearer perspectives of exactly what the bill is going to do in terms of our mandate and the mandate of other organs of state, such as Transnet and DPE and so forth. And in so doing, we discovered that it's really not about the sale. The sale is an issue, and yes, the sale is an extremely important thing. It's an important issue of that's of concern to all the citizens of the country. But Transnet was probed on that. And they did a presentation that said, look, when we did the sale, we did it in terms of these laws. Yeah, we followed these procedures, we put these bids open, and we did all of this. So they came and they addressed the sale issue. Whether, in fact, that was in fact is dependent on scrutiny of other laws, as Joanne was pointing out earlier. There's another legal framework that regulates that aspect. And Transnet was trying to convince everybody in which they, and the Thames presentation, to say, well, look, we did this process. That, for the purposes of this bill, should be treated as incidental. What the issue is, and I think that this is the Honourable Mokwena's concern, is how is the bill affecting the sale, and if so, are we dealing with that? You can rest assured, Honourable Mokwena, that insofar as the sale is concerned, their concern was we sold off stuff legally, but if the bill comes into effect before we complete our contractual obligations, there may be certain difficulties that we're going to have, because you've taken all of this, which we previously thought belonged to us, to do with as we please, which was the extended sea areas.
Mm-hmm.
There were very small portions of that which were part of this deal. Now, if we want to fulfill our obligations in terms of this contract, your bill is going to make it difficult for us.
I'm not confused. You are saying, as you say, that Transnet was saying, as you are saying, we started the estate at the cost of the
family. They sold it.
But then, if you guys from DP come up with this law, how will that impact on that sale?
Okay. That's what we need to unpack, because that seems to be the concern. Remember that the most part of that sale is land and buildings. And the land and buildings has nothing to do with the ITM board. That needs to be understood. That's the major part of that sale, is buildings on the V&A waterfront and little bits of space there that that was sold in terms of other legislation, not part of the ITM concern. But included in that, there were other portions of sea within little portions of sea in the bay areas, let's call it that, that had already been reclaimed through the processes that existed then in terms of the Seashore Act and the EIA processes. Well, we presume that this was the process that was followed. And that was already done and dusted, and that formed part of that sale. It was previous laws. But in addition to that, there were also other undertakings that there's a little area there in Granger Bay. I don't know how exactly what the extent of that is, where there was plans which formed part of that deal, because at the time, remember, when the sale took place, it was the Transnet was operating without knowing that the ICM bill is coming along. And they said, well, fine, this area here, they said, we've earmarked, in my view, that was a risky decision, but it was a decision that was taken anyway. That this is part of the deal, and later on we will be...
This is taken by whom?
By Transnet and whoever at the time. I can't answer for Transnet. But the point is that that's not the issue. The issue is, in terms of the vote, that part, the part of that land, which is part of the sale that Transnet effected within itself, is land that has not yet been reclaimed. So in order for them to fulfill that part of that obligation for themselves, they're going to have to go through the process that I outlined in Section 27. Now, I want to assure the committee that we've been battling with Transnet, and believe me, the chairperson is correct when he says Transnet is not happy. They're not happy, his team is not happy, or they would not be sitting here today. They're not happy with the situation because they of course, would like more out of this. They would like more safeguard or more security in that instance. But that is just one issue. Okay, the sale is just one issue. But they have relinquished, insofar as their interactions with us, their plea for us to exclude those areas from coastal public property. In other words, Transnet, albeit resistantly, have accepted that when it comes to that land, they're going to have to fight out that battle, and they're going to have to follow the rigorous EIA processes, which has been made more rigorous by this bill. They're going to have to get that land excluded, and they're going to have to come to Parliament to get it excluded. They are prepared to fight, or they're not, well, they are forced or put in a position where they're going to have to do that because of this bill. So effectively what has happened is that sale issue is really taken out of this equation, because what was discovered subsequently was that there is a larger problem. It's not the issue of the sale. It's the issue of there are financial obligations in the ports themselves, financial security issues, where they have to enter into long-term leases so that they can get guarantees from the banks to develop legitimate ports. And in order to fund themselves, they need access and they need maneuverability of those areas. And the bill will impede on that. And, of course, we would be unreasonable to say, Transnet, go away, we don't care about this. That is not in the spirit of the Constitution. So when they came to us...
The bill will impede on that in what way?
In that it says that is coastal public property, you're not allowed to lease. And the banks are going to say, banks are not interested if it's government. The banks are going to say, I'm sorry, I'm taking my money away, go and get your money somewhere else. And they're not going to get people who's going to enter into leases because they need at least 66-year leases. In order to make it financially viable, because the Lees people are giving them money so that they can then take that money and legitimately develop the physical port areas. Forget about the extended areas. This is the physical footprint. Let's call it the footprint of the port. Now, in that area where there's ships, vessels coming in, this is in our interest because we have foreign trade, we have customs and excise, we have a whole lot of different interactions that happen in ports that impact on government per se. Those are the areas, and that's the issue that came out, which was the more important issue for the bill. And I'm not in any way diminishing the concerns around the sale, but I'm saying that that is an issue that Transnet is living with right now. They're not happily living with it, but they're living with it. When they came to us with the other port areas, and they said, these are the areas where if this bill goes through as is, we're going to have serious difficulties. The banks are going to pull out on loans. They're not going to give us future loans. We are not going to be able to fulfill our mandate in terms of the National Port Act, which says we must develop ports, which is in the interest of the entire South Africa. That's really the crux of this.
Yeah,
so
sure,
we
sure,
have
sure,
to...
Sure, sure, with due respect. Again, very well advocated. But then I take issue with you saying this thing has got nothing to do with the sale. Well, that's the crux of the matter.
Correct. That is exactly my point,
yeah.
Member Mokoena. Now, what I'm saying is don't get confused when we talk about an exclusion coming to Parliament for ports. That exclusion does not include at all the affected V&A issue. This is about all the other ports that is within Transnet's mandate to manage and to fully utilize and operationalize. So these, because that's the bigger issue, and that's the more important issue, and that's the impact, the issue that impacts on the nation as a whole. Because if our ports come to a halt, we're going to have some serious economic problems. The ICM bill is not intended to do that. And we are now trying to find the best possible solution in order to address that effectively.
One little question. One question, that's all.
That will be your last question.
Yeah. My question is...
That will be your last question.
Yeah, my question is, I mean, the advocate is in the shop. I mean, she is now towards the end. She said something that actually opens up my eyes. Because I don't know if you're talking about people. Now, I'm asking myself as a lawmaker here. Let's see about 5 or 6 months. Must we rush this bill and settle the country with very serious legislative consequences? Or should we rather say, hey, this is far bigger than we had thought? I've always thought this was the thin end of the wedge. Now, I think I'm vindicated. I'm not even going to say this. But if you said, this is just a little portion that is over the other bigger concerns, now, I wouldn't like to be accused of paralyzing the economy in respect of the ports. At the same time, I wouldn't like to open up the sluice gate. And then they say, through that instrumental of that law, that committee that morning, when they passed the thing, they then open up the slow stage. So that's my real concern. Because very big, cabinet is liable. I mean, liable not in terms of having, because this situation comes from there. Now, that's why when last time, when the coordinates were shown, somebody stood up in front of the president, they had a coordinate, I said, is that what happened to cabinet? You see, because right now, they're talking about the coordinates. I've not even seen them.
I think the question you should be asking from the top is this. To what extent does this legislation undermine the Lake Shell deal? I think the Lake Shell deal goes ahead with irrespective. It's there, it has happened. It does complicate certain aspects of it, but the deal went ahead a long time ago. What will be complicating our future development, and if we do complicate them, it will be in the interest of the country. That's my approach.
Yes.
So, can you answer that?
Okay, that is what we currently saying. When we say that there's another matter coming through for ratification, it's that very exclusion that we're talking about. Because we have, exclusion from coastal public property, of the footprint of the port area, which we already have documentation in place. And DPE is saying, no, we want to delay this whole bill till next year because we want this amended in the bill. We're saying the portfolio committee has seen fit to put a mechanism in the bill to deal with these very situations. And what we are doing is we're in effect going to implement this section that the portfolio committee initiated to deal with that. So their problem is catered for, and we are using the mechanism which is available here to do this exclusion.
That parliament was ultimately...
Yes, and what we want to do is we are sensitizing you, and I'm glad of the opportunity to the issues that are going to come before you very shortly, of course. Because we would like this to happen as quickly as possible and have the ratification happen as quickly as possible so that we can achieve those objectives simultaneously.
It means the Congress of you might have to work even on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
We move on. I don't think there are any other further questions. I've noted you. We will discuss these things during the week. Okay? And then I think we'll be talking about the question.
Sorry?
You know, so something else that you said earlier, when I think of correct, you know,
Sir, how do you control?
No, we say go for a ticket break. We get all the briefings, take a break, then interact with some of the stakeholders,
okay.
And then come and find out. Okay.
All right, can I begin Chair? Okay, Chair, I'm now going to go through the amendments that were made by the Select Committee on the Waste Bill, and request the committee to deal with the waste bill for approval. I think that essentially most of our, I mean, certainly we aren't into anything as complex as the last discussion. There were a number of technical errors and sort of language and grammar.
Yes.
I don't want to say from this is one of the things that people could be around during the break. So that I can at least brief you on our stand. Help you from the department, but
I think the first thing this was done in the Select Committee is that there were a number of small errors that were picked up and we corrected the errors. The second thing is that there were a number of places in the bill where from the provinces there were representations that the rights of MECs hadn't been fully or consistently put into the language, and we've done that. And then there were a couple of content proposals. Might I say that the waste bill became a very big issue in the provincial consultations. There were huge debates and discussions and quite large meetings in the provinces. And so I think that having gone through this process, and once we conclude here that, in fact, we've got a piece of legislation that I think is livable with by everybody. Okay. Right, I think you can actually go through the first two pages. Okay. Go. All right. So the NCOP process was conducted in May and June. All nine provinces submitted their negotiation mandate. A lot of the comments received were the same as the comments that had already been made to this committee and that had been processed. Some comments that were made had already been addressed in the legislation through the amendments that this committee had made. And then all provinces supported the bill, and the amendments are as follows. The first amendment was to the definition of waste. And the definition of waste was amended to specifically mention waste generated by the mining, medical, or other sectors, so that you could have a specific identification in the definition of waste that there are particular sectors that generate particular waste streams. It doesn't impact at all. The one on the right hand side is the proposed is the change shift.
So we don't have the document.
None of us have.
This one is landscape format. Another one.
Yeah.
We don't have.
That is scope, doesn't come with definition.
Yes, and we are now on the page that says clause one.
And this D39D is amended, right?
Yeah. Okay, and what effectively it does is that the definition of waste is approved by the Portfolio Committee, talks about different substances, different types of waste, and what this new amendment by the Portfolio Committee is to open the way for the definition of waste, the Select Committee is to open the way to deal with waste by sector. So it's an addition. It doesn't in any way change or harm the definition, but it opens the way for us to deal with a particular sector that generates a particular kind of waste. So we felt it was an amendment that we could very easily live with. The second definition was to insert a reference. And we talked about there was an error, and we talked about the Finance and Fiscal Commission Act. In fact, it should have been the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act. So that second change to Clause 6 is merely a correction to get the correct reference in. Then on Clause 29, there are two insertions that were the Portfolio Committee felt quite strongly needed to be done, which is to put a time frame on the presentation of an industry waste management plan prepared by an organ of state or an industry waste management plan prepared by the provincial department. And essentially the issue there was that there was a concern from the provincial hearings that a lot of things, people are meant to do things and they don't do them because there isn't a time frame. So it was agreed that in the regulation to the Act, that in the Act we would put in within a stipulated time frame, and then in the regulations to the Act we would set out a time frame. So it was about governmental efficiency, I think, more than anything that amendment to Clause 29 was proposed. In relation to Clause 35, in the Portfolio Committee hearing, you will remember that the banks came along and they had concerns about the issue of liability for contaminated land. And the Portfolio Committee compromised and basically had a clause 2 which said this part does not apply to banks which held land before the commencement of this Act, and which land is sold for the purposes of foreclosure, provided that the land is sold without delay. And basically what then happened in the provinces was that there were numerous stakeholders and, in fact, some of the provincial departments that said that they felt that if the banks held land that was contaminated, they needed to take the same level of responsibility as anybody else. If the land reverted to the bank then was in the same position as another land owner, and they took this out. So I think that this is the one substance change. We felt that we could deal with this in the way that we implemented the system, that we could give the banks the necessary notice. And I think that the other thing that I think that we feel, I mean, in the light of the current international financial crisis, I mean, a lot of the problem that we are seeing internationally is that banks issued loans without knowing what they were, the value or the risks or the liabilities of what they were owning. And that a lot of the subprime crisis and the international collapse we're seeing at the moment is because the banks didn't, in fact, take full ownership of their assets and their liabilities. And so I think that there was, I mean, that wasn't raised in the provinces, but basically we think that, in fact, it's going to make the banks much more careful about what they're doing, and if necessary, they're going to have to go back to their mortgage holders and deal with it. So we think that we can live with it. It is a change from what the it takes us back to the original version of the legislation as it came to the Portfolio Committee. But I think in the provinces, really, from the provincial legislatures, from the provincial departments and from stakeholders, there was quite a strong feeling that it should remain as it was originally. So that is Clause 35. then we look at clause 36, and most of the rest of the changes include inserting MEC. It's a correction, in fact, to include MEC, that there were a number of situations where the MEC clearly has the role and the authority. If you look at the beginning of the chapter on contaminated land, it is something that is shared between Minister and MEC, but we weren't consistent in our language. So in 39D, we've added must notify the Minister and MEC of contamination. In 39D, it says that the Minister or MEC, as the case may be, depending on who deals with it, so it provides for the province to deal with it. Then on clause 40, oh wait, hang on, are those the two? Am I right? Oh, it's here. Okay. Yeah, okay, then on to clause 47, it's just substituting may invite written comments from any organ of state that has an interest in the matter, and we're saying must, because basically you don't want a situation where government is intending to take action and then we don't. Someone decides they're not going to talk to the municipality. This makes it clear that you have to go to the organs of state who have an interest. And we thought that that was a good amendment. Then lastly, on there are a couple more small things. On clause 66, on page 35, after line 24, there's incorrect numbering, and we've just corrected the numbering. The number of clause 3 has been, we've corrected the numbering there. So I think, Chair, that those are the changes. They're largely minor editorial corrections. And then on this issue of the banks, there really was, I think, every single pro-provincial legislature mentioned this issue in their mandate and felt very strongly about it. So that is, those are the proposed changes to the WASC.
Anyone who is violently opposed to the government?
Obviously, more clearly.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not actually opposed to them, but I'm overly excited about the fact that it has reverted back to its original form in terms of contaminated land. So they should be just as responsible as anybody else.
Okay. I'm just trying to think that the cause for the contamination may not be caused.
No, the cause of the contamination may not, but the banks, it's when the land goes back, when the bank becomes the owner. So if the bank forecloses and they then hold that land and they own it, I mean, normally what happens is that they're going to have to declare. I mean, there are a number of options they have. The one option is, in fact, what it means is when they sell that land on, when they put it, auction that land, they're going to have to say, we are selling a piece of land, that land is contaminated, and in selling it, the new owner is going to have to take on the responsibility of cleanup. Or they are going to have to say, because we can get better value, we will clean up and then we will sell the piece of land. So what it means is that they're not in a position it's the land that they already have. If that land is contaminated, they are now going to have to deal with it. Yeah.
The rook should be under the carpet.
No.
Do they have a responsibility to clean up if they hold it over an extended period of time, or can they just sit with it contaminated?
You see, what we compromised on, we said where the land is with its existing contamination on land that they already own, we'd leave it. But where it was land that they're buying that comes into their ownership from the time of the bill, they would need to deal with it. So, but the original thing said, listen, if a bank, if you foreclose, so in other words, if the bank no longer takes back the security and takes the ownership to themselves, they must deal with it in the same way as any other landowner, whereas in fact we gave them an out in relation to land that they already own. So now, let me give you an example. If there is a factory that has been operating and that factory has a bond
in favor, Standard Bank has issued a bond over that land. And then what happens is that the business has contaminated the soil. And then the business now, and Standard Bank issued that bond 5 years ago. And then the business has now contaminated that land. If we had accepted what the portfolio committee said, if the business then went bankrupt and Standard Bank took it back, Standard Bank wouldn't have had to deal with the cleanup. Now we're sitting with the situation in the legislation where Standard Bank will have to declare that the land is, will have to take the land back, and if they hold the land, they must clean it up. If they on-sell it, they've got to on-sell it with a full declaration of the fact that there is a liability, and therefore the price at which they sell that land must then be adjusted to ensure that the new owners, to reflect the fact that there is a liability on the land that the new owners are going to need to deal with.
Just to follow up? Do you think this might be an opportunity if a land, in exactly the same example you gave, then becomes a situation where the factory does not manage it, whatever it does properly, and there's contamination going on, but the land has given it, the bank has given it an extensive mortgage. Does the situation arrive anywhere in the world where the bank then says, hey, hang on, we've got a vested interest in that. You guys are messing up our vested interest, and we don't like the way you're running your business, and if it so happens that we foreclose, we're going to be stuck with it. Would it not be an opportunity to say, listen, do something about what you're doing?
Thanks, CDG. Firstly, if you just refer me to the relevant part that says that you have to declare that the land. If you sell it on, you're saying you have to declare. Is it implicit?
Well, in terms of, at the moment, banks have to do nothing. Okay, so if all chemicals, with all its mercury contamination, is sold tomorrow, no one has to tell anyone anything about what in fact has gone on this land. Okay? And in Section 40 of the bill, what it says is that the bill will put into place a situation that says no person may transfer contaminated land without informing the person to whom the land is to be transferred if the land is contaminated, and in the case of a remediation site, without notifying the minister or MEC and complying with any conditions that are specified by the minister of MEC, or MEC as the case may be. And what we then do is to say that the minister must then notify the deeds registry of that fact, and that the deeds register must then enter it. Now, at the moment, there's no disclosure of anything. What the banks then said is page 25 of the bill, clause 40. That's what it says. The banks then asked for a clause to be inserted, which we did, that said that in the case where the banks have a mortgage over a piece of land and they foreclose, they won't have to comply with this in the case of land that they already owned, and that it would be a future provision. Now, contamination is in general a retrospective thing, so it was quite a big compromise. And what the provinces, what the people in the provinces and everyone else said is don't make that compromise. That basically, if the land reverts back to the banks, why should they not be treated in the same way as any owner then is? So that's effectively to what taking that out does. It puts the bank, if the bank holds the land for a substantial period of time, they must then deal with it in the same way as another owner would. I think that the issue for me is that what it does is that it brings into the fact that on existing land you're going to get a proper risk rating. Whereas they wouldn't have had to declare with a compromise, now you're going to get accurate risk. And I mean, really, you don't want someone going and buying soil chemicals for 25 million rand and then discovering tomorrow that in fact there's 50 million rand of liability on that land, because now when they become the owner they're going to have to clean up. So I actually think it's not a bad thing to bring the banks under this regime.
Good. Good. I just think that should have said that.
Would there be a fine for non-disclosure?
Honorable Poema.
Yes. Now, I'm happy with the attention of the community. I just want to ask the presidential question, which is very germane, though. ISCO in the VAF has polluted the VAF. The water table is basically contaminated. Now, to what extent does this apply to the ISCO's extent now?
When the bill becomes law, it applies fully.
I think I've answered my own question. My head is not the fault of this bill, but we will put ourselves in situations where the bank, where land that's been financed becomes contaminated at the point of finance it was fined, is foreclosed, goes back to the bank who sells it on, and then can't recoup the costs of the loan. But I guess, and am I correct, is my logic clear? I guess that that is not the fault of the law, and it's actually not even the fault so much of the bank. It's just a product of risk. Yeah.
I think the consequence of this is going to be is that when banks is that, I mean, part of this, the implementation of this is that we've got to keep a register of contaminated land, and that at both provincial and national level, we do proactive things about identifying contaminated land. I think that what you're going to see happening is that the banks are suddenly going to get very interested in those registers of contaminated land and are going to be very wary about issuing bonds on them, or if they are, they're going to price in the risk and the cost of the cleanup. That is effectively what the consequence is going to be. So in the same way as increasingly now when banks loan, they're lending. I mean, if you look at what's happening with bonds on coastal properties, banks are starting to price in climate risk. You know, if they're not prepared to issue a 5 million rand bond on a piece of coast, on a house that is right on the edge of a cliff where a storm surge could then cause huge damage. So they're starting to price in a set of environmental risks already. What this does is to bring forward the pricing in of the contamination risk. And I think that banks are going to start writing into their contracts things like that: if you allow this land to be contaminated, then we reserve the right to either change the valuation or do this or do that. So I think you're going to start getting pollution will start having the cost of pollution will start becoming internalized into the way that the banking system works, which I think is in the long run probably a positive thing. And I think that we will then need to work quite hard with the banks to work out a way that this doesn't cause catastrophes, that we implement it on the basis of the register and work with them on it, which we will. We'll go and meet work with the banking council quite intensively.
Maybe just on that, John, is there a work in the department now around the auditing this contaminated land?
I think, though, from where we're sitting in terms of our own capacity as a department and resources that we have in terms of budget, this is one clause that would have to be delayed in terms of the coming into effect of this deed into law, because I would imagine, I mean, the risks are not just on one side, even for us. We should be able to then define proactive ways of dealing with the implementation of this provision. Mm-hmm. And that includes, I mean, things like when, during the sale of property, there could be a certification process, which is similar to when you have an electrification certificate. But it would mean then we have people, or we can have specifications around how then we arrive at that. And the implementation plan that the department would have to put in place would have to be able to then effectively give effect to the implementation of this. And it is not just only, I think the concerns of the banks were valid in respect of the fact that, I mean, they would end up with a whole host of money that they cannot recoup after they've invested, simply because various properties have become contaminated over time. And at this point in time, ourselves, we are not in a position to say this is the extent of the problem in terms of that contamination. So I don't think it would be responsible for us to then expect that day one, when this bill comes into effect, we are going to be able to effect that clause.
Because it may not necessarily have any much cost for us. I think the fact that there is this bank about liabilities, whatever, they're working with people everywhere. It is also incumbent on them to double check the state of condemnation of the land that they're working with. So, yes, it may be costly, but actually, the cost is on the banks. And I think it's about time that they do something there.
Can I say that in terms of information, I think through the law enforcement work that we are doing and through our assessment of the state of the landfills in the country and through some of the planning projects that have been done in provinces, there is quite a lot of information that would need to be consolidated. But I think that the one important part of this implementation plan would be to pull all of that together, to put aside funding, to be able to start to really create a baseline database. And that would be something that we would then set funds aside to do the research, starting with our industrial areas largely. So one, and Gauteng to a large extent has done this exercise. Western Cape has done some of it. So we'll work with the provinces to create the baseline register, and then we'll have to then over time kind of fill in gaps.
Thank you, Chair. I'll say ladies first. Okay, you go first.
Just around the whole issue of non-disclosure, would that if there was pollution ongoing and it could be proven of that it was sold on and there was non-disclosure, would that have been picked up earlier and the new massive fines that are to be imposed for environmental mismanagement and pollution? But if it wasn't picked up, there should be some way of it being a major disincentive to selling on without disclosure if the fines for so doing were substantial.
Is there another question, colleagues? I want to try this out.
Thank you, Chair. What I wanted to say is perhaps this might create an opportunity for some insurance underwriting companies to look at deals of that kind to make sure that financial companies, before they can issue out their bond, they would require you to take a cover that would have to at least protect their investment. Just the same as you buy a car, you cannot drive out without having a comprehensive insurance cover, and the first lien holders would be the financial company to cover themselves. So I would look at it from that point of view, and I think it's a very good thing.
Should I respond firstly to the issue of Sasol? Yes, this to Mittal Steel. From the moment this becomes law, it affects them, and they are aware of it. In fact, and you know that we have a series of law enforcement actions against them, including a criminal prosecution, and they are now working on a long-term environmental cleanup program that is quite big in terms of its money, and that is in fact going to address it. And I think that anxiety about these measures is in part what has moved them. In relation to the question, yes, it's an offence not to declare. But from the time that the bill comes into law.
No, I'm not asking. Mittal Steel,
Retrospectively.
No, I'm not allowed to speak.
Oh, okay.
So, yes, I can agree. I think this is going to result in new insurance, in the creation of new insurance vehicles. And yes, the contaminated land section is retrospective. It is on page 23 of the bill, part 8, 35. There's a clause called application of the part. It says the part applies to contamination of land, even if the contaminated land occurred before the commencement of the act. And then there's a whole lot of things that is actually retrospective. Thanks.
We can know that it's wrong, but it will be addressed. So I want to come with a formal process around this. Committee report of the Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs and Tourism on the National Environment Management Waste Bill, Bill 39D of 2007, National Assembly, Section 26. Dated 22nd October 2008. The Portfolio Committee on Environment Affairs and Tourism has included the National Environment Management Waste Bill, Bill 39D 2000. Information that could be included in a report submitted to the section 1 or 2.
Agree.
Then we come to the committee report. Report of the Postal Committee on Environmental Affairs and Torino on the National Environment Management Waste Team 29th October 2011. National Affairs Inspection Resolution dated 22nd October 2008. The Postal Committee on Environmental Affairs and Torino have requested the National Environment Management Waste Team dated 19th October 2007. National Affairs Inspection Resolution amended by the National Council of Provinces and referred to the committee report that it has agreed to the VM. They move over to the document of this report. Over to Kamala Hosley. Over to Kamala Hosley. Over to Kamala Hosley. Is there someone still from DPA here?
Yes,
yes.
They're outside.
Why do you think
that... Chairperson, question? When are we going to go through clause by clause of the laws bill, which we did yesterday?
We'll have to do it today.
Let's do it today.
But we didn't do clause by clause, that's why...
Yeah, we didn't do clause by clause yesterday. Shirley's one of them.
I've got one here. But not the amendment.
Okay, let's just, in the meantime, can we look at that and make photocopies of the document and then just go to the cross and cross. Can you attend for about 10 minutes and then let's see what the information is going to be. On page 25 and 952, on meet end. Agreed on that?
Mm-hmm.
On page 25, after line 53, following the first paragraph. 3, one or more members of the committee based and on communal organization, and 4, one or more members of the scientific or coastal research institute. Have agreed on that?
Okay.
Clause 49. On page 29, in line 47, to omit end. Agreed on that?
Mm-hmm.
On page 29, after line 50, to add the following sub-paragraph. 5, address coastal erosion and accretion, and 4, to deal with access issues. Agreed on that? Clause 56. 1, on page 32, in line 13, 14, 15, 23, 31, 34, 35, 43, 45, 46, 49, 50, 53, 55, 56, and 58, to omit zoning and substitute planning.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed on that?
Mm-hmm.
On page 33, in lines 1, 4, 7, and 14, to omit zoning and substitute planning. Agreed on that?
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Clause 57, 1, on page 23, in lines 15, 16, 19, 21, and 22, to omit zoning and to substitute planning. Agreed on that?
Yes.
Clause 71, on page 41, in line 56, to omit end. Agreed on that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. On page 41, after line 56, to set the following paragraph. F, transboundary impact and international obligations. And standard and agreed on that?
Yes.
On page 41, in line 57, to omit F and substitute G. Are you agreed on that one?
Yes.
Clause 83, 1, on page 47, in line 54 and 40, to omit zoning and substitute planning. Are you agreed on that one?
Yes.
On page 46, in line 52, after property to insert all. Agreed on that?
Yes.
On page 46, after line 52, to add the following subparagraph, A, any activity which has an adverse effect on the coastal environment. That A is the Roman A. Are you agreed on that?
Yes.
1 on page 49, United States, after obligations to inspect and enforcement. You are clear on that one? Clause 95 on page 51 in 98 to omit land or premises that form part of. You are clear on that? Do we agree on all the amendments that have such and such a greater force? Let me come to the formal process. Committee report of the portfolio committee on environmental affairs and tourism on the national environment management in the Kajet Coastal Management Bill, Bill 40 in 2007, National Assembly Section 76, dated 22 October 2008. The portfolio committee on environmental affairs and tourism has requested the national environment management in the Kajet Coastal Management Bill, Bill 40 D 2007, National Assembly Section 76, amended by the National Council of Tourism. And refer to the committee report that it has agreed to the deal. Is there a move for the adoption of this committee report? Dr. Katalia Manzan moved and supported by veterans. Okay, thank you very much. Here we come to the very last. Report. Is there a move on that we adopt the amendment broadcast by the MCOP on the National Environment Law Amendment Bill? There is a move for that? Yes. Can you then go also close and call? National Environmental Law Amendment 335 from 2007, amendment agreed to. Clause 3. On page 3, after line 16, to insert the following paragraph. D. The National Water Act 1998, Act number 36 of 1998. Our agreed on this?
Agreed.
New clause. 1. That the following is the new clause. Insertion of section 31DA in Act 107 of 1998. 4. The following section is hereby inserted in the National Environment Management Act 1998 after section 31B, designated of environmental management inspectors by Minister of Water Affairs and Forestry. 31B A1. That the Minister of Water Affairs and Forestry may A designate as an environmental management inspector any staff member of one, the Department of Water Affairs and Forest, or any other organ of state, and B, at any time withdraw a designation made in terms of paragraph A. 2, a designation in terms of subsection 1, A, and 2 may only be made by agreement between the Minister of Water Affairs and Forest and the relevant organ of state. I'll agree on that. Substitution of 31D of Act 107 of 1998 is inserted by Section 4 of Act 36 of 2003. 5. The following section is hereby substituted for Section 31D of National Environmental Management Act 1998. Monday. 31D 1. When designating a person as an environmental management inspector, the Minister of Water Affairs and Forestry, or Ministry, as the case may be, must, subject to subsection 2, determine whether the person concerned is designated for the enforcement of this Act, of A, this Act, B, a specific Environmental Management Act, C, specific provision of this Act, or a specific Environmental Management Act, D, this Act, and all specific Environmental Management Acts, or E, any combination of those as a provision of this Act. Who can anything be designated a person as an environmental management inspector for the enforcement of only those provisions or any specific environmental management act? A, which are admitted by the MEC or the provincial local state, or B, in respect of which the MEC or the provincial local state exercises the health form assigned or delegated power or duty. 3, a person designated as an environmental management inspector may
exercise any of the powers given to the environmental policy inspector in terms of the state that are necessary for the inspector mandate in terms of subsection 1, and that may be prescribed by Minister of Water Affairs and Forest or MEC, by not inviting for the inspector. I will agree on this amendment. Long title, 1 on page 2, in the 6th line of the long title, after definition to inspect, to authorize the Minister of Water Affairs and Forest to designate person as environmental management inspector. Are we agreed? Agreed on all these amendments.
Yes.
Then to read the formal part of the report. Report of the Portfolio Committee of Environmental Affairs, Tourism and National Environment of Environmental Affairs, Tourism and National Environment, Laws Amendment 1935, Section 76, dated 24 October 2008. The Portfolio Committee on Environment Affairs and Tourism, having considered the National Environmental Laws Amendment 235/2007, National Assembly Section 276, amended by the MCB and referred to the committee, report that it has agreed to the bill. Is there any move for the adoption of this report? Congratulations.
I
shall
move to the report.
Amended by the I think that.
I think we can just assume that you will represent us on all these bills in Parliament from the just the chairperson's report. There's no need to debate any of them. Secondly, Chair, if the committee section can just look into. Firstly, I support you on your previous. On the coastal bill and the need for urgency. Somewhere along the line, we're going to have to ask for the three-day rule to be dropped. The coastal bill is going to get passed by Parliament on the 18th of November. It's already on the green paper. Okay? Which means that we can only consider the coordinates and that report at earliest on the 19th of November. The last sitting of Parliament for the year, as we currently know, is the 20th of November. So somewhere along the line, we have to publish that report in the ATC on the 20th of November. So somewhere along the line, the three-day rule has to be broken, which is exactly made for circumstances like this. That shouldn't be a problem. So that has to be prepared for. And the only other alternative, which I suspect is entirely impossible, is that this committee agrees to break the three-day rule and pass this piece of legislation in Parliament tomorrow afternoon, which means that we can meet to do the exclusion earlier and we have more time. And I lay those on the table as serious considerations because we could get trapped by Parliament and we've only got 5 sitting days left this year, and 2 of which are in the next 48 hours.
Chair, I just also want to follow on the same lines of the three-day rule, the NEMA amendment, Bill 36, the EIA one, would be finalized by the 11th, by the select committee, and would like this committee to consider it for finalization during this term.
Can I add on that? It was voted on in the select committee yesterday, but their first plenary is only on the 11th of November, which means we would need to get it into this committee on the 12th for adoption in one for finalisation on the 18th. Yeah. So I think we're also going to need to ask if there's interaction between the two committee chairs and with Parliament in order that can move straight from the NTOP directly to here for the hearing. I think the other important thing about that is if that one doesn't get passed, there's a lot of other things in the other legislation that then is going to be highly problematic, particularly because of the definition of environmental authorization, because it all relates back to the amendments to Chapter 5. So if we don't get Chapter 5 concluded, we are going to sit with a very big legal problem.
one more recommendation, Mr. Chair. As I said, I suspect it's difficult. If we can make a recommendation somehow to pass the Code for Management Bill tomorrow, then it's out of our hands and it's in the hands of the department and the minister. Then we can do the, we can meet on the 12th to do the NEMA bill, and if need be, the if we can, I don't know if that's possible, but if we can get the exclusion. Well, you see, it's probably only possible that the proposal when it's signed, but at least it helps get us towards solving some of these problems. Yeah, I mean, if the president can sign before the 12th, this whole system will work perfectly.
I think
that's
what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, just my concern. Just my thank you. My concern just relates to us being able to get transit application in timely, so that it's almost simultaneous. Once the president is appointed, the ratification by Parliament happens virtually simultaneously. Otherwise, there's a risk.
Look, I think we can manage it. I'm not sure that the person can change
it. Yeah, well, that's for sure. Well, I think we need to pass it tomorrow. When he signs it, is the president's issue.
We can pass it.
We're going to have to suspend the 3-day rule. I don't know what the process is that. I mean, I support it. But if need be, we can meet with
the
Okay, we'll take that.
Thank you.
That's the chief reason.
Thank you, Chair. We are the members. Thank you very much. It's a real record breaking to conclude all this legislation in one sitting.